Could you build a business that's better for our planet? That's what I have set out to answer. Hi, I'm Marco Pimentel, marketing expert and entrepreneur and host of the podcast, Someone Like You. I become fascinated in finding creative climate solutions in business, and on the podcast, I break down how founders and CEOs are building climate-friendly business solutions that are opportunities for growth while being better for the planet. I wanted to take a second to tell you about our Season 2 sponsor, Springwise. Springwise is the global ESG innovation platform that offers its readers early access to the ideas transforming our world. I actually started using Springwise probably 10 years ago to review innovative startup ideas, and I've been a fan ever since. There are three new stories on the site every weekday featuring solutions to some of the biggest challenges we face as a global community. You'll find innovations in climate tech, renewable energy, plastic alternatives, the circular economy, and how we can live a more sustainable life. The stories are sourced and written by the Springwise team of journalists and will give you an inspiring take on what's right around the corner, whether you read it to inform your work or simply for a regular dose of optimism. Springwise sets the innovation agenda. The newsletter is free to access, and to sign up, visit springwise.com/newsletter-signup. Every day, millions of people around the world lack access to reliable electricity, forcing them to rely on dangerous and expensive alternatives. But one entrepreneur, Sam Goldman, is on a mission to change that narrative. With degrees in biology, environmental studies, an MBA, and a passion for social transformation, Sam has dedicated his career to making clean energy accessible and affordable to all. During his time as a Peace Corps volunteer in Benin, Africa, he was inspired to find safer and more sustainable ways to power homes and businesses in underserved regions. His passion for social impact and innovation laid the foundation to founding D-Light's transformative work. Under his leadership, D-Light has positively impacted over 170 million people in 70 countries, saving customers over $5 billion in energy expenses. It's no surprise that he was recognized by Forbes as one of the world's top 30 entrepreneurs and was named Social Entrepreneur of the Year by the Schwab Foundation for Social Entrepreneurship. Today, Sam leads a team working on a project at Innovative Breakthrough Energy Technologies, where he continues to drive impactful change by addressing lightning-induced forest fires, which is a significant contributor to global carbon emissions. Join us as Sam shares the inspiring story behind D-Light's inception, from its humble beginnings to an ambitious vision of reaching over 1 billion people by 2030. Discover how Sam's dedication to social impact, resilience, and innovation is lighting the way to a brighter and more sustainable future. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Marco.
I'm excited to have you today. We get to talk to a very seasoned entrepreneur that, you know, we get to talk about your story from building to now continuing on with new ventures. And so, but let's first start at D-Light. And I want to just kind of take a step back to understand your background, how you got into thinking, you know, climate, sustainability, you know, making this difference with D-Light. Like where did that kind of start?
Yes. Interesting question. So my parents worked in international development. And so I lived my whole life and did all my schooling overseas in places like Pakistan and India and Peru. And the one place that was sort of a fixed and home was here in British Columbia, a small island called Hornby Island. And we'd come back every summer. And Hornby's an island, off an island, off of Vancouver Island. And so it's sort of out there. And it's this kind of magical paradise full of, you know, people who created these incredible communities, lots of artists and innovators, and then in this stunning natural background. But it also has its challenges. So when we were there in the summer, there's not very much water or any water. We had a well on our property, but you really learned how to live with, you know, using your resources very wisely. And Hornby, although it has a population in the winter of, you know, probably like 500, which swells to maybe 10,000 in the summer or something. So it has this incredible waste management and recycling setup, far more advanced than even some of the largest cities on this tiny little island. And then I think from a sustainability perspective, you know, 35 years ago, when we wanted dinner, I'd put the canoe in the water and go out when I saw the herring bubbling and catch a couple salmon, and we spearfished for crabs, and we got our oysters and clams, and it was just this paradise. And by the time I was in college, there I wasn't fishing at all. There were no salmon. And so just watching this incredible change happen has really driven me to think about how do we protect this world?
Yeah, the personal kind of, and I'm a fisherman as well, and I've often tell people is that it's such a quick experience of catching lots of fish and then not catching as much fish is it really a span of almost, 15 or 20 years, which is quite shocking and quite prevalent, and you really, really notice it, and that can definitely give a spark to a lot of people. So, you grew up with this type of perspective and understanding, went to university in Stanford, and you were in a specific type of program. Kind of walk us through maybe that kind of program and what kind of sparked you to go into Stanford. And this was a program, I believe, that was focused around innovative entrepreneurship.
Right. Well, I'll back up a little bit. So I got my biology and environmental studies degree at University of Victoria here on Vancouver Island, and was kind of a stout anti-capitalist, at the WTO rallies and things like that. Ended up riding a bike with a group called the Climate Change Caravan across Canada, and as part of that, decided I wanted to go into the Peace Corps, which because I'm a dual citizen. And it had been positioned and stationed in the Republic of Benin in West Africa. And while I was there trying to do the good work, it became so apparent to me that business was really what was making things happen. And I needed to get on board with business and understand how to do it in a sustainable way. And so that drove me to Stanford. And it was kind of a fluke that this was the first year that there was this interdisciplinary program there, which they called the D School or the Design School, which melded grad students in medical engineering and business together in their first class, which was called Entrepreneurial Design for Extreme Affordability. And so I was really getting an MBA, but I had this class and I spent, it was just one of my classes, but I probably spent 20% of my time on it because it was fascinating where you learned the, how to do how d about design thinking and how to do design the way the leading firms like IDEO did it. And then you got to apply it to a client. Ours happened to be one in Myanmar. It was an NGO there. And the group that I was working on had decided that we really wanted to look at the impacts of bringing, better lighting to families in Myanmar that were still burning mostly diesel as their only source of light.
And so, quite literally, that was kind of the bit of the spark of let's see what we can do. And so, how did you solve that diesel or kerosene issue and challenge while you're at within this program?
So yeah, we had a couple of engineers and a couple of business students on our team went to Myanmar, did our final project, and it's fascinating. This is one of those things where you have to have a big enough sample size. So we did our work in Myanmar, and actually my co-founder and I had gone afterwards to Cambodia, and they're probably two of the only countries in the world, especially when we were there, where the grid was literally moving on kids' shoulders in the sense that there was these homemade lead acid batteries where kids would melt down the lead plates and put them in and pour them back together again, and they'd put in the acid, and you'd go to these shops where they had these old massive Chinese generators, and they would say, that it's charged when the acid is bubbling, and they'd boil this acid in these batteries, and then when it was charged up, they'd load it onto bamboo poles on the kids' shoulders and bring it to a house, and then you'd get like 1 or 2 days of running a incandescent bulb or maybe a very old black and white TV or something off it, and then back to get recharged. And so that's what we came into, and we had initially actually founded or had put a patent in for fast charging technology for sealed lead acid batteries. And we said, well, if we can just have a sealed lead acid battery and a really small one and leverage LEDs, which were just becoming, quite popular and at the beginning of their efficiency curve, we said, oh, if we can do this. And so our first prototype was a sealed lead acid battery, a little, what's in the emergency light, 6 volt, 4.5 amp hour battery hooked to a little PCBA that we had strung together with some LEDs. You couldn't even recharge it, and gave it to a woman named Mia. I remember her very distinctly. And came back a couple days later to her house, which was up on stilts and, all of bamboo. And she was literally crying. And we were just like, oh, well, what happened? And she's like, you can't take it. This is amazing. It's changed our lives. And we're sitting there, going, there's no way to recharge this. You can't take it to your, local generator person. We're sorry, it's just a test. She was saying, no, my family makes mud bricks. And, we wake everybody up at 10 p.m. at night. We go out, we dig all the clay. We use these diesel which smokes everywhere and it hurts our eyes. And we lay out all the bricks up during the whole night so that in the morning when the sun comes up, it'll bake the bricks. And then we sell them for, one brick was about at that time half a US penny per brick. And we need this. This is like game changing. I'm so scared that the, diesel will tip over, burn our house down. We know all these stuff, all this stuff coming out. So that was pretty moving. And so we decided, after we all went off to our other jobs that summer, but when we came back for the second year of our program, it was like, we got to do this thing. There's something real here. And that was kind of the genesis for for D-Lite.
And we chatted earlier, and D-Lite being the class was D, the D class, I believe, is what you said. And so you
The D
do D
school,
school.
which was kind of a play on people call them B school, business
Yeah.
school. And so they're kind of a little bit of making fun. But yeah, our class projects, we were like, oh, what are we going to call it? And then we were just being a little cheeky. We were like, well, we'll call it D-Lite as sort of a play on all those words.
So you have this idea, you obviously have it for like just an incredible experience, a moving experience of just somebody that gets to have a better technology to live their life. You come back into your second year and you say, well, let's do something with your founders and let's kick off D-Lite. What was your initial product idea to go back to and test?
Right. So in that class, we had had that experience and the Myanmar experience. I, in Peace Corps, had lived for almost 4 years with a kerosene lantern and had that experience in West Africa. And I actually had a what had driven me into the design school into wanting to work on lighting, because all the other groups in our class worked on water, was that my next door neighbor in my village actually almost died in a kerosene fire. And so I had already done a lot of the research. It was, at that time, again, this is 2006, about 1 million people a year were dying from fires, from kerosene tipping over and then burning down houses or parts of villages. And at that time, there was about 1.6 billion people in the world still using kerosene as their only source of lighting. And so I had these stats. I was already interested in this. I'd already written a bunch of LED companies from Africa saying, can I be do distribution? These things will be amazing. We could create a business out of this. Nobody would write back or was interested. So when we got together and said, let's start a company, he said, okay, we've had this experience in Myanmar, but the size of the problem is gigantic. Carbon credits were just becoming more of a real thing back then. There's carbon credits at work. We've got LEDs, which are just starting to come up. The costs are starting to drop. The efficiency is starting to go up. Let's see if we can build an integrated product that can charge in less than an hour or an hour and a half off of any AC connection or generator, and then give people light for about a week. And if we can do that at a cost that mimics what they would otherwise pay for kerosene, but give them a much safer and better experience, no brainer. Total win. And so we went out and built that. Our first light we had called the Forever Bright. And actually a funny story, because we wanted it to work with AC too. Not funny, really. I mean, funny in hindsight because nothing happened. But we put it out with all these families. We were super excited about it. People loved it. And then one day our electrical engineer came in and he said, I think if people turn this thing on and they've got it hooked up charging on AC, even though you said none of our customers have AC, but if somehow they got it and they did that, they could electrocute themselves. We got to recall all of these. We're just like, oh my gosh, how are we going to do that? In the middle of Cambodia and other places. But turned out fine. Nobody got hurt. And so we were kind of off to the races. And And yeah, we raised our Series A over $1 million on a pitch which said solar's not the answer. Solar's too expensive, because it kind of was still then. We're going to do this fast charge thing, leverage, AC, which is everywhere, and give people tons of bright light.
And the idea being is that obviously at that point, like you said, LED is there and it can hold a charge and it lasts, obviously the efficiency of it comparatively before. So and for your customers, they just needed that cost to be pretty much the same and the ability to have something that lasts a lot longer.
You need it to be under different, different markets, different amounts, but I would, definitely under 25 cents a day in cost. It was one of these situations where the poorest people in the world pay the most for their energy services, and in this case, just for like one kerosene flame, they would end up spending, about 10% of their family income. So if you could get under
Wow.
that cost on a daily basis, and most of them worked daily. So kerosene, for example, nobody went out and bought, a gallon of kerosene, and which would be cheaper, and used it. In my village, for example, had been in, they would sell the kerosene would come over the border from Nigeria at night, and then they would put it into little plastic bags so that you could literally buy one night's worth for the money you had.
And so where were you and the team located? So you raise $1 million on a Series A. Where with this idea that LED is the answer, solar doesn't really work right now, it's just too expensive. How where like where did you start? Did you have half the team in the United States at Stanford still a school and then people kind of in the field? Like how logistically how did you start to kind of put that together?
Yeah, we were your typical, literally a garage in Silicon Valley kind of situation with the five founders. We had two mechanical engineers, one electrical, and two MBAs. And we did close our initial sale from there, but very quickly realized this, all of our customers and all of our businesses overseas, we're not going to do this by commuting. And so we agreed very early on. I had gone to school, high school in India, said I'll go to India and set up our operations there. India was the largest off-grid market at the time. And my co-founder and one of our mechanical engineers had, family relations to Hong Kong and China. Our ME spoke Chinese, so they went over and opened our Chinese office in Shenzhen so that we could have the manufacturing expertise. And we have, effectively shut down the US office and moved overseas.
Every week on Someone Like You, we dive into stimulating conversations with founders, entrepreneurs, business owners, and the likes who are consciously and successfully creating sustainable business solutions for the long haul. Tune in every week for a new inspiring conversation on leading climate solutions. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please share it. And also, don't forget, subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and a review. And so, like one of the challenges right away that I just see is just like cost and financing. So, like you said, if people are buying a bag of kerosene for one evening, there's just no way that I'm assuming, maybe not no way, but I'm assuming is that they can't afford to buy this new chargeable LED light. Was that the case? And like, did you ultimately build really kind of like a financing product and model to be able to allow your customers to be able to purchase and afford this over a period of time?
Yes and yes and yes. And this is one of the things, I think is so common for entrepreneurs is, we feel like if you've got your amazing product, they will come. And we were absolutely convinced that if we could get a product, in the sort of $5 range, sort of in the range where people could sell a chicken or two kind of thing that they had around and be able to afford it, where it had, let's say, a payback period in the weeks, not in the months, that and totally transformed your life and gave people incredible light, that this thing would just fly, it would just take off. And some of our early, product development projects too, we would call them, like the code name was the no risk light, because we would say, okay, we need to build something that nobody's ever done. We need it to be so inexpensive that there's no risk in putting your money down, even if you lost it. You would not be losing that much. that it can't break. You need to be able to throw this thing off a six-story building and it lands and it keeps on working. It can go through monsoons, all the, dirt dust. You can literally drive a car over it. Like, we're going to make this thing no risk so that the poorest, most vulnerable families in the world can actually bet on this new brand and this new product that they've never seen. They don't know what LEDs are. They certainly don't know what solar is. By this point, sorry, we had transitioned to solar where I'm going now. Because as soon as we got to India, we realized our AC products were not working at all, and solar is magic. Anybody who sees solar, they're just, how is this working? This is incredible. I don't have to pay anything ever again, and it just char I just stick it outside, it charges, like, incredible. So, and we can get to that in a second. So, yeah, so we had this idea, if we do this, we're going to sell 1 billion of these. I mean, it's just an absolute no-brainer. And it's true, when you would give them to people, or for the early adopters who bought them, they would just rave about it. I mean, it completely, it's night and day. You're on kerosene one day, you move to D-Lite, your life will never be the same again, and you'll never go back. It's incredible, but it doesn't take off. And it took really, a master like Seth Godin coming out and visiting with us in the villages in India, and then coming back and saying, it's, your customers are not consumers. They are not in the habit of just buying even $5. So they're going to watch for like 6 months and see if this new thing works and delivers before they really consider it. And so it became very apparent that if we really want to scale, yeah, we have to take the price down. And that's where everything changed. And I'm happy to share a little bit about those stories of scale.
Yeah, well, that's a it really it's to get to that point where you think that, what everything that you're saying to build sounds like incredible for obviously $5, but that's here in North America, and then, that is a lot of money for people to do. So you figure this out, you say, okay, well, we really need to get some sort of financing solution so that the barrier to entry to try this and see how it works is dropped. How what was your next steps once you had that realization, and how did you start to scale this? Because, how do you even sell these across these kind of large countries as well that are used to buying kerosene every single day? And like that just seems overwhelmingly difficult to scale.
Yeah, so we had, as many entrepreneurs and companies do, our share of lucky breaks. And I would say one of them, because clearly we had to build massive distribution into rural areas if this was going to work. And we tried to work with various more typical consumer goods or white goods companies, or even agricultural supplies companies to do that. And it wasn't working. We just weren't core to them. It was a new idea, a new product. They weren't going to build our brand for us. And it turned out in about two, like late 2008 onwards, the microfinance industry in India, which is massive, some of the bigger companies, like at that time SKS Microfinance had, more than 10,000 loan agents on the ground serving, millions of customers, that they were in a position where they could off go sort of beyond loans, and they could offer a top-up product if people wanted it, and if that product was, transformative and sustainable. And so they decided they wanted to test whether their women would be interested in having a solar light on top of their loan as an add-on. And it took off like crazy. And so at the time when we didn't have the money or expertise to build our own distribution, and we needed things to be financed but didn't have the balance sheet to do it ourselves, we managed to, in India, to crack working with these microfinance institutions at scale. And so we went from a situation where we might sell, we had a bell in our office when we were small, and if we made a sale, we'd ring the bell. I mean, it was at that point, it's like, even if you sold 200 in a day, you'd ring the bell, to a point where, we could do over 100,000 in a month. So just a, magnitude, order of magnitude difference. And those MFIs demanded a lot of things. So they demanded an even way higher sense of quality than we were willing to put up with, because they said, this is our brand. This is an add-on product. There's no way we're going to have our, women getting mad at us, frustrated, not paying back their loans, doing other stuff because of this light. So your quality better be impeccable. You guys have to deliver it out there. We're not going to do all the delivery for you. If our women have an issue with after sales, you're going to have to fix it within X days at their home. And India is vast. And, who does this stuff? Who delivers to people's homes? Who does, after sales at somebody's home, and does all this on products that, were under $30? It's kind of wild, but we did it. And that allowed us to say, okay, in the world's biggest market, we now have distribution, we now have financing. We can raise Series B, we can build out the team, and we can move ourselves into Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, where there was massive pull. We had partners who were already selling our products, but it wasn't scaling the way we thought the market needed it to. And that's where we figured out this new business model, called pay as you go, where because mobile phones were becoming more popular, because mobile money was becoming more popular, we could put a chip into the products and a keypad on the products and essentially say, okay, why don't you pay us a very small amount up front and then pay us daily? We'll SMS you a code, and you enter that code on your keypad, it will unlock your solar home system or solar light for the amount of time you paid us for. So you can pay us for one day, which is what most of our customers did, or you could pay us for, 4 months. It doesn't matter to us. We'll send you the code. We'll unlock it for that time. And then once you've fully paid, we'll send you an unlock code and the product's yours. So it's kind of a lease to own model. And we were part of the, one or two companies that basically created this technology and pioneered it. And that was the scale story for us in Africa, where the MFIs weren't there to do it. So if you wanted to do Africa, you had to build your own distribution of finance yourself.
And you mentioned earlier about solar. How instrumental was solar and the price of, well, both, I guess, the technology of solar improving and the efficiency of solar panels and also the cost to all of this plan? Was it kind of the technology that you really needed to be there to scale this across both Africa as well as India?
Yes, for scale. And when I say scale, I mean, to reach, we now reach what, 170 million people. So I think you could get to 20 million on the old costs, but you can't get to 170 million, and you definitely can't get to a billion. So we're just fortunate. And I also, part of this is, again, it's that luck thing. We got into this business right when the cost and efficiency curves on solar and LEDs and the battery technologies were just really starting to get into their exponential curves. So, between 2006 and today, we've seen, LEDs are now a little flatter, but they've been incredible. So we can get the same amount of light off a battery that's a fifth the size. And the batteries have become, order magnitude, a tenth cheaper. The solar panels are so much more efficient, but much more importantly, so much more cost effective. So for our market, which was all about cost and quality, the quality's gone up, cost has gone way down. It's the perfect combination.
So to fast forward to kind of 2024, you're no longer active on the day-to-day side of things with D-Lite, but over all these years, how much has D-Lite, raised in funds to, as well as like, I believe there's a goal out there that, to transform a billion people by 2030, which is such an incredible goal as a business, but also just in terms of what your product can do and the lives that it can improve along the way. What does that look like today?
Yeah, the more we scale, the more money we consume. Because in a sense, in India, we still work with many of the microfinance institutions, and so we can, effectively leverage their balance sheets. But everywhere else in the world, we found, we have had to finance it ourselves, or our partners have had to finance it themselves. And to do that, that means, we're all, if you're giving somebody a couple hundred dollar solar home system for $10 down or $20 down, the balance is going on your AR. You got to finance it somehow. So we've raised hundreds of millions of dollars in both on and off balance sheet debt, mostly to fund a combination of solar home systems, super efficient DC fans, super efficient televisions. We also have gotten into smartphones because it was largely when we asked our customers, we said, we know you like us and think of us as a solar brand, but what else could we do for you now that we have these distribution and these pipes? And people were very clear. They wanted to have their first smartphone. They want to have their first lights. They wanted to have their first television. They want to have their first fans. These basic necessities of living in these environments and being connected to the rest of the world. So we now enable all of that through consumer financing. And so, yeah, in total, probably about $500 million raised at this point.
And yourself, you've moved on from Delight. I would maybe not move on is the right word, but you're no longer active in the day-to-day part of the business. What was that decision like, and what have you been thinking? What is the future for you?
Yeah, I'm down to a day a week. We have an incredible executive team, and we hired, a little more than a year ago, an amazing CEO named Nick Amudia. My co-founder and I, we never wanted to, be CEOs necessarily of a public company or of a very large global entity. We really wanted to get it off the ground, get it started, and do everything we can to make it successful. And I feel like I've kind of done that. And I have so much confidence in the team and their ability to scale it, but it was kind of a, it becomes a decision for every entrepreneur if you where you want to eventually raise your family and live for the long term. And so after COVID, we found ourselves back here on Vancouver Island. And I'm feeling drawn back into the climate space really strongly. It's not that at D-Lite we didn't do a ton of climate work. We actually offset about 35 million tons of CO2 over those years, which I did the math. It's about equivalent to planting,
Wow.
550 million trees. So I feel good about it. And
Wow.
lately, we opened up a category for clean cook stoves, and it's one of the things I'm most excited about. There's almost 2 billion people in the world still cooking on open fires, or three stone fireplaces, or other. Just burning charcoal and wood. And you can give them effectively a smokeless stove, and you can subsidize it, 70 to 80% with carbon credits so that it becomes affordable. And it's one of the, best, in some ways, easiest and most equitable climate solutions we have as a society. And D-Lite's through our distribution, we're one of the answers to that. So I'm super excited about it. I think it's going to make a big difference. But that said, my heart was kind of here in Canada and North America with my family. And as I did my research, and looking at the fires last year, 2023 in Canada, it became pretty obvious to me that that was the problem I wanted to work on. And just to give you some headline numbers, Canadian wildfires last year burned about 5% of the forest in BC and in Canada as a whole. It was a little more than 5% of all the emissions for the whole world. So just the wildfires last year put out more carbon than any countries in the world except China, the US, and India. So, the biggest.
And that was and that's not a season that's
No,
very
that was in
long.
the five in 5 months. So it was about 2.4 gigatons of carbon out there. And when I had compared that to Africa, because he was like, no, that is, and different people have different numbers. So, because none of this stuff, it's very hard to know exactly how much carbon, but it's more than Africa by most standards. So, and it's more than, so it was like, oh, wow, I'd have to get, clean cook stoves to like 600 million people, or, we got to deal with this fire issue in Canada. And so just recently I've joined a group called IBET, Innovative Breakthrough Energy Technologies, and I'm leading a team looking at lightning-induced wildfires and seeing if there is a way that we can somehow mitigate this lightning so that we can buy ourselves time for prescribed burns and other, improved forest management practices and deal with this carbon bomb.
Yeah, because in Canada, obviously, and lots of other countries where wildfires are becoming, are a big impact and becoming more and more prevalent as things get warmer, drier. There's a list on of environmental reasons why we're having more fires, but a lot of people start fires too, but those ones are typically closer to urban areas, which typically are a little bit easier to put out. But the big bulk of fires come from what happened naturally through lightning, and also, and you probably know this because you're doing the research on it. I don't believe Canada actually even reports these emissions when they consider their emissions for Canada as in terms of like fossil fuels and all the other emissions that we make. I think they exclude anything to do with natural events.
That's correct. They're not in the nationally determined targets, so they're kind of off the books. And it is a natural process, as you say. It's not that, the boreal forests, and Canada has, almost 10% of the forests, and the boreal forest is the largest ecosystem in the world, terrestrial ecosystem. But so they naturally burn. It's just that they don't burn like they did in 2023. And as you said, with the heat, there's going to be more lightning. There's going to be more lightning igniting fires, and there's going to be a lot bigger fires. And we've suppressed fires for the last 30 plus years, so there's lots of fuel out there. So unless we do something about this, you got to think about it. The wildfires last year were three times the emissions of the whole Canadian economy per their actually reported numbers, the determined targets. So even if you could make all of the Canadian economy net zero, it would be like one third of the fire season last year.
And these fires, from a capital understanding cost perspective, are very, very expensive as well. And I'm going to guess that's just from trying to put them out, the cost to for firefighting, the cost to the economy because of what the disruptions happen, the cost of tourism. Like, well, do they have any sense of like what this fire costs the Canadian economy? Not even considering just obviously the cost per ton of carbon that was emitted into the air. There's no hard cost on that, but what is the real kind of cost for all of these fires?
Yeah, I've been trying to put some of those numbers together and I don't have an answer. But what the answer looks like to me is, over 100, just in Canada. Of course, the fires are everywhere in the world. Look at Australia, Europe, Brazil, US. I mean, they're happening everywhere. But just in Canada, because it's top of my mind right now, last year over 100,000 people evacuated, multiple forest firefighters were killed. The smoke across the continent, the health implications of that kind of smoke that swept all of the northeast of the US, large swaths of Canada all summer long. The disruption, Fort McMurray is one of the largest economic zones in Canada, was completely burnt just a few years ago. So we're talking easily billions of dollars.
And when you think about this as a place to work in and try to look for, effective change here, is this a private initiative? Is this a private public initiative? How do you think potentially, and obviously you're really, really early in the stage of this, where do you think that will work out?
I think it has to be private public. I believe in the private sector to move quickly. I believe in competition. I know there's probably lots of other people working on, similar areas. Certainly, we're seeing new VCs popping up in sort of fire tech. So it's really exciting. I'm so glad so many people are working on it. But at the end of the day, a lot of the land that's burning is controlled by governments. They have their wildfire management services. A lot of the land, used to belong to and be managed properly by indigenous groups. And now in many places it's being, there is some more, thankfully, joint ownership about decisions and hopefully more in the future. So there is going to be a mixture of organizations that need to come together to solve this. And I'm glad that it's starting to move in that direction.
And I bet right now, and what you're doing is this at a stage that you are, friends and family round? Are you doing, a small seed round? Like what stage of the, I guess, both sides of it between the research as well as potentially spinning out, a company to start putting out some ideas and strategies to mitigating this?
Yeah, it's been so far. It's internally funded by IBET, and they're kind of an interesting organization, by the way, if you haven't heard of them. The idea was that they took a bunch of seasoned executives and entrepreneurs and put them together and said, okay, let's go look at problems. We haven't developed anything yet. Let's just go look at problems with this group of people, see if we can come up with some solutions that we actually think we could build a product or a solution around. And then if we do, we've already got sort of seasoned people who know how to raise money and run companies and do things, then we'll go for it. And so we've internally funded it, and we'll plan to, yeah, in the next couple of months, I think we need to do like a small seed round and friends and family to prove out a little more of the R&D, and then go for, a proper, and then spin it off as a proper company on its own with a Series A.
As we kind of wrap up the podcast, I just you built up and part of this founding team to build out D-Lite. It's been incredibly impactful, it both from, I'm sure, multitude of things, empowering people's lives through light, empower health wise, and I'm sure burning kerosene to smoke stoves, all these things like that. That all of that's impactful on people's health as well. So you've had such a impact with D-Lite, and it's been such a growth story and success, and yet you're obviously now going back into climate, into potentially a new area. I think a lot of people always kind of just they think about their role in this kind of capital business and climate change, and just kind of unsure about like their next move or next path. But like, what kind of advice would you give to that type of person that's kind of on that fence of, maybe jumping into something like, into like climate solutions or sustainability solutions?
Oh, jump. I mean, it's to me, it's the only thing right now, but that's because I think I've been doing so much research on it, and it definitely can keep you up at night. But it's kind of an existential threat. I want everybody and anybody who can, getting into it. And I also think at this point, almost every business, every organization is going to be involved in some way in climate and sustainability. I feel like it's inevitable, and we all have to do it. So I don't think you can go wrong stepping in. And if you haven't already got, a solid footing there, all the more reason. I feel like all the evidence that I've read about suggests that people who are new to a space or to a team and have different perspectives and ideas are actually what makes the team so successful. So, bring it on. Go do something new. Go join new teams. Bring your ideas and expertise. Don't be afraid to speak up. Like, it's an opportunity-rich environment. There's so much to do. Anything that somebody's passionate about, I think if you spend enough time, you'll find the people who want to do it with you. Just need a little bit of patience.
Sam, thank you so much for joining us. How can people maybe learn a little bit more about D-Lite and maybe learn a little bit more or follow you on social?
I'm not huge on social, but I do respond on LinkedIn, and glad to be found there. And obviously, D-Lite and IBET, the websites are up, and there's more to learn about there as we go.
Sam, it was a pleasure. Thanks for telling us your story and best of luck.
Thank you very much. Take care.
I hope you've enjoyed today's episode of Someone Like You. We're a new podcast, and I would love if you can do a few things. One, please share the podcast with a friend, a family member, a work colleague, anybody that you can think of that would enjoy learning more about these incredible brands. Please also support these type of companies. They're doing the hard thing, and the hard thing often takes a lot of people to get on board. And don't forget, please subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and review. I'm Marco Pimentel. Thank you for joining us today. For more information on Someone Like You,
You can find us on Instagram at Someone Like You Podcast, with all the links to the podcast, our website, and more information about the brands that we feature. Thank you again.